From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Thanks for tuning in. And joining us by phone, he's John Englander, and he's the author of the new book, Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level and the Path Forward. John, thanks so much for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth.
It's my pleasure, Chris and Nell. It's my first interview since the book was published this morning, so it's notable.
It's it's a big day. Congratulations.
It's a big day for both. We're honored to have you to chat with us about this book, because actually I wanted to start here. In 2012, you wrote another book, High Tide on Main Street, which also addressed rising sea levels. And here we are 8 years later. So how are things unfolding in as far as rising sea levels? Are they rising as expected? Are they rising quicker than we had predicted? How's that going?
Great question. And the truth is, it's ahead of schedule. I hadn't quite thought it was going to rise this quickly. It's the acceleration that matters, the melting of ice on Greenland and Antarctica primarily. And most people wouldn't notice the difference, of course. We're still at 5 millimeters a year, which is like a tenth of an inch or something. But it's the acceleration rate. It's kind of like with the pandemic and, looking at the forecast for how many people have the coronavirus, that it's quick. It's nuances in the acceleration rate and the compounding or exponential growth that really matter and surprise us. And that's certainly been the case with sea level rise.
All right, so 5 millimeters a year, like you say, it's almost virtually unobservable on a year-in and year-out basis. But this has been going on for several decades now?
Yeah, and in fact, thank you. It's for the last three decades, it's almost doubled every decade, and that's what's ominous. Because if we'd only stayed at 5 millimeters a year, we'd have a foot and a half by the end of the century, or over a century. And that would be significant, but it's the acceleration, because it could be 5 or 10 feet this century, given the acceleration of the melting ice on land and the rising sea level. It's hard to see because we're concerned about storms and, extreme high tides and other coastal flooding events, which are maybe 5 or 10 feet in a day, and that's of course gets our attention. Sea level is like the drip filling the bucket, I say. You don't notice the effect with each drip, but we know that eventually the bucket's going to overflow, and that's what's about to happen.
Well, I'm assuming by your 561 area code, you live in South Florida.
I do.
Okay, and that seems to be kind of tip of the spear with respect to rising sea levels and their impacts. Is it showing up more often there?
It is and it isn't. And it's a great opportunity to actually clarify. Everybody thinks of Miami and Fort Lauderdale when they think about sea level rise, or New Orleans or Venice. But sea level rise affects every coastal community. I mean, you're high and dry up there in Utah, I believe, or somewhere up in the Rockies. The water will never reach you. But the fact is, it's thousands of coastal cities. It's from Boston to San Diego and Seattle to Tampa, and around the world from Shanghai to Singapore, Mumbai. Every coastal city is affected by rising sea level. Sea level has been fairly stable for all of human civilization, or recorded human civilization, 6,000 years. But sea level goes up and down hundreds of feet. We just tended to be ignorant of that. And now it's changing. And we've got to rethink the coastline.
But, we see sea level, we see stories about Miami and South Florida with respect to king tides, right? Full moon related flooding, blue sky flooding, etc. Is that occurring more often with greater frequency?
King tides are a phenomenon been known for over 1,000 years.
Right.
It follows an 18.6 year cycle, or sometimes called a 19 year cycle, and they are very predictable. And because of rising sea level, the extreme high tide, and particularly the king tides, are getting higher and higher. It's true. But it's not just Miami or the Florida Keys or Fort Lauderdale. It's Annapolis, Maryland. It's Seattle, Washington. It's Portland, Maine. And so when I push back on the Miami, making Miami the poster child for the problem, it's really to get us to think it's not just Miami. Mm-hmm. It's every city on the coast in the world. So places like Mobile, Alabama, Galveston, Texas, Charleston, South Carolina, Savannah, Georgia. We don't think of those places. They are seeing it at king tides. I was at I gave a talk in Annapolis, Maryland a few years ago, and at a maritime museum, and was explaining this phenomenon. And when we were done with the presentation after lunch, we couldn't get out of the building because the extreme lunar high tide, the king tide, had actually come up high enough that it blocked the front door.
Hmm. Wow.
as almost as an invited guest, surprise guest.
Yeah, it made the point very, very well.
Well, it's also interesting you mentioned Annapolis and the Chesapeake, right? Because a few years ago we interviewed Earl Swift, author of the book Chesapeake Requiem, about Tangier Island and the slow disappearance of Tangier Island. You mentioned it in your book, too, as an example of perhaps a community that is very conservative politically, doesn't necessarily believe in global warming and rising sea levels. They see it as I recall, more of just a function of erosion and weathering, et cetera. But again, that's a great example of somewhere other than South Florida that is feeling the effects of rising sea levels.
It's a wonderful example, and I'm glad you did notice it. It's right at the end of the book, and I talk about an exchange between President Trump and the mayor of the town, and I don't get into politics at all, but they're discussing whether the flooding on the streets is because of sea level rise or just something natural. And whether it relates to climate change. And I'll let the readers, pick up on what it says. But again, I stay out of the politics, but Tangier is a perfect example. It's sinking partly because of subsidence of the land, but partly because of sea level rise. And it's following the path of two prior islands, Holland and Sharp's Island, which already are gone. And the residents get it, even though the politicians may want to, say it's not happening.
Well, I was just going to ask a little bit more about that dynamic. In these places where we're starting to see severe impacts, do you see kind of the citizenry there saying, hey, this is climate change, this is something that we need to, face, we need to address this sea level rise, or is there sort of some denial about that?
Well, people are follow a wide spectrum, and of course I'm seeing both because I travel all over the world, or at least until the pandemic came, and more and more people recognize that the flooding is getting worse, and when they combine that with the wildfires and all the other weather extremes, they realize that climate change is here just as forecast. But it's confusing because we get snowstorms in Texas while we're talking about global warming, just as happened a few weeks ago. But I am seeing that more people take this seriously. They realize this is not political, this is not a hoax, it's not made up by somebody, that climate change is a serious phenomenon that we have triggered. There was natural climate change, like the ice ages, as I point out, but we've now broken out of the ice age cycles. We've broken out of the natural cycles, and we know why. And more people are getting concerned and asking serious questions. There's always going to be a few deniers for politics or beliefs or whatever. But more people are taking this quite seriously.
We're speaking with John Englander. John is an oceanographer and the author of the new book, Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level and the Path Forward. We're going to get into some of the resiliencies and adaptations and opportunities you talk about with respect to this challenge, but I do want to spend just a few more minutes on the science here, particularly why in the book you say that Antarctica is a critical component to sea level rise.
Sure. There's three primary sources for global sea level rise.
Okay.
One is ice on land breaking off and entering the ocean. That's like dropping an ice cube in a glass of water. It will raise the level of liquid. And that ice is on Antarctica and Greenland primarily, 98% of the world's ice. So that's one. Two is if there's meltwater from ice on land that gets to the ocean, that also will raise the level of liquid, just like pouring more water in a glass. And then the third thing is what we call thermal expansion of seawater. As the ocean's warm, they get slightly larger. But back to the big factor, it's ice on Antarctica that you asked about. If all the ice on Antarctica were to melt, sea level would be 185 feet higher, 56 meters. Mm-hmm. Now, that hasn't happened in 30 million years of the planet's history, and it's not going to happen anytime soon. But the problem is, even if 5% of that melts, we have 9 feet of sea level rise. And that could happen in the next 100 years or so.
Mm. One of the points you make is that, you know, sea level rise is unstoppable and unpredictable. Why is that? To explain a little bit why, you know, if we just stopped emitting carbon in the next few years, you know, why that would still be an issue.
Mm. Sure. Really important questions now. We've already warmed the oceans because of the extra heat trapped in the atmosphere by the greenhouse gases. We've already warmed the oceans in the last century about a degree Celsius, which is 1.8 Fahrenheit, or let's round it up to 2 degrees Fahrenheit. It takes a lot of energy to warm the oceans, as you can imagine. In fact, it's almost unimaginable as an amount of energy. As I point out in the book, it's about the equivalent of 500,000 atomic bombs being exploded every day.
Wow.
That's the amount of heat energy we're putting in the ocean. Even if we stopped all carbon dioxide emissions today, if we could somehow magically switch to all renewable power today, the heat that's already in the ocean is there. It's not going anywhere soon, not for centuries. And the amount of ice on land, Antarctica and Greenland, will get less on a warmer planet. That's happened repeatedly over the planet's history. We've kind of taken it out of the normal cycles, but that's the reason I say that sea level rise is unstoppable. Even if we did all the important things, being more environmentally concerned and reducing our greenhouse gas emissions. The unpredictable part, the second part of your question, is equally important. If you imagine ice miles high covering North America, which is the equivalent of Antarctica and Greenland put together, and so that ice is more than 5,000 feet tall, we're trying to predict exactly how much will melt in the coming decades. And while there are lots of projections, essentially they're all wrong, because nobody knows exactly how much ice could melt in the next 80 or 100 years. And partly that's because we don't know how warm the planet will get, because we're still arguing about energy policy, whether we're going to use renewables or burn all the coal or still use the tar sands or find new nuclear sources. All of those things are going to determine how warm the planet gets. So without knowing how warm the planet gets, there's no way of knowing exactly how much ice will melt.
All right, so let's turn our attention to concepts of, like you talk about, resiliency and adaptation. First, I'm always a little confused as to the difference between what resiliency is and what adaptation is. Can you provide a little primer on that?
Sure. Yeah, no, it's a great question. They're used in different ways by different people, and it's important that a word has a commonly understood meaning or we're not communicating well. So it's a perfect question. In fact, I use 3 different words. We talk about sustainability, resiliency, and adaptation. The way I distinguish them, sustainability is the things we can do without harming the resource or continuing, you know, kind of indefinitely. And that would be like renewable energy or recycling. Things like that are sustainability. Resiliency is the ability to endure and recover from an event, in my book. So after preparing for a storm, preparing for heavy rainfall, preparing for what do we do with wildfires, those require that we design with greater resiliency. That's not preparing for sea level rise because we're not seeing sea level rise yet. And in the next decade, I'd be surprised if we saw an inch or two of sea level rise. But we're looking ahead by mid-century, 30 years from now, within the life of a home mortgage, we're looking at the possibility of several feet of sea level rise. So preparing for a flood that could happen next week is resiliency. But that doesn't get us looking out to sea level rise that could happen in the coming decades. That requires adaptation. So that's why I separate climate change into three issues: sustainability, primarily in the area of greenhouse gas reduction, sustainability, preparing for the extreme weather events happening now, and adaptation, preparing for what we know is coming at us, particularly rising sea level.
And in this book, you kind of maybe move on to the next step from your last and really focus so much more on that adaptation piece and, the path forward, as you say in the book's title. What's next? You know, how do we live in these places? Do you expect to see, you know, is this more about moving cities or moving population centers or about retrofitting our
infrastructure, et cetera?
Yeah.
All of the above. You know, when you think about it, when we get over our denial and angst and concern about the fact that the planet's changing in so many different ways, as you know, and you've covered in your great program over the years, when we realize that sea level is going to be several feet higher, several meters higher eventually, we're going to have to do everything you just listed. We're going to have to move some cities. That's already started happening, but people don't want to move. I mean, even in places like Ile-de-Jean-Charles in Louisiana, there's $48 million been set aside to move a few hundred families, and a third of them don't even want to leave. People have a place attachment. There are places where new architecture and engineering to raise buildings up will help and buy us some time. We'll be doing innovative things like putting more things on floats, and more people will live in mobile homes or recreational vehicles where they can move location as the floods get worse. Some people will probably migrate to boats or floating cities. We're going to do all these things, but it's not a question of if we're going to do them. There's no choice. If the ocean is higher foot by foot, we will adapt, but we'll either do it with crisis and catastrophe or with planning and adaptation. And although we might not want to face the music or hear the music or see what's in front of us, my case, as you quote, is that we really have no choice. And the sooner we begin planning for the future, the better for us, our investments, our communities, our children, and future generations.
Well, it's interesting, John, that, you know, as a homeowner, you may not want to leave. And you may say, well, I'll just put my home up on stilts and I'll be fine. But, you know, the municipalities around there, around the coastlines, the government infrastructure may say, well, you know what? We don't have the money to constantly repair the roads that you live on or put in larger stormwater pumps or provide you with water and electricity and emergency services. So there's a couple of things in play here. It's not just that the homeowner wants to remain and employ acts of adaptation. Infrastructure also has to do their analysis, their cost-benefit analysis, and say, we're not going to provide you the services you need because we can't afford it anymore.
No, you're absolutely right, Chris. In fact, there was exactly the case you described in the Florida Keys last year. The four southeast Florida counties from Palm Beach, Broward, which is where Fort Lauderdale is, to Miami-Dade, to the Florida Keys, which is Monroe County, they worked together on projections for sea level rise. And at the conference last year, they identified that given the projections for sea level rise, that they could no longer afford to maintain certain roads in the Florida Keys. And some homeowners would find their homes stranded, actually becoming mini islands at some point, because the roads would not be maintained. They would have to take boats to, you know, to the mainland, in effect. But it just wasn't economical. The city actually did the calculation. I can't remember the exact number, but it was something like $85 million would have to be spent just to maintain the road to three houses that were on the tip of a key. Mm-hmm. So you're exactly right that economic decisions will have to be made. At the moment, we seem to have an attitude that, you know, the government's responsible to ensure and take care of people without limit. Now, that's admirable and understandable that people would like to do that. But as your question suggested, there are limits to the economics. I mean, even the federal government cannot buy out every coastal homeowner at full property value.
I'm curious about the role of insurance as well. You know, I think people want to buy flood insurance, you know, homeowners insurance, and think that that covers them. At what point is insurance going to kind of, these insurance companies going to kind of say, hey, we can't insure this entire area, you know, or this entire town? And are we seeing that happen yet?
There are a few places where insurers have pulled out of the market. So, yes, we are seeing that. In the United States, most flood insurance is underwritten by the federal government, the National Flood Insurance Program, or NFIP. And they keep trying to improve the NFIP rules, but there's great pushback from Congress because our members of Congress want to keep the voters happy. And they're getting caught between a rock and a hard place because the desire to have cheaper flood insurance is actually understating the risk of flooding on that property. And in effect, it's encouraging continued living there or continued development. So we're caught on this issue of insurance premiums, but you're right that insurance is a key issue. The one disconnect that I point out in the book, as you may have noticed in the chapter on insurance, is that we have a few policies that are actually working against us right now. But one fundamental issue in insurance is that insurance rates only look at flooding for the next 12 months because insurance policies are year to year. They don't really incur much sea level rise effect yet because sea level rise won't be bad next year. Sea level rise is, again, like that drip filling the bucket. So sea level rise requires that we look like 10 years ahead, and insurance companies don't do that. So we have to look at the insurance issue from several perspectives, as I talk about.
We have just a few more minutes, and I always like to add in the fact that, you know, sea level rise is not just a physical impact to the environment and to our economies, you know, flooding, erosion, etc. There's also a chemical and biological impacts. The chemical impact, as an environmental engineer who worked in South Florida on water treatment plants, is that the fresh salt water interface in the groundwater moves inland. And so now, again, municipalities have to start spending more money removing that salt, let's say, and other impurities from encroaching salt water. So there's a chemical impact in that sense. There's a biological impact too, as salt water, freshwater interfaces move further inland. Estuaries are impacted, biological ecosystems are impacted, etc. So it's a very three-dimensional impacts that are going on, physical, chemical, and biological.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Chris. You're absolutely right. I just probably just applaud your description there. Sea level rise is going to affect the freshwater supply through intrusion, as we call it, as you know, and it's going to affect estuaries, the fish breeding grounds, as we go from saltwater to fresh or from freshwater to saltwater, even places like the Everglades, which is so important for restoration here in Florida. But restoring the Everglades to the freshwater river of grass that it was in the middle of the last century is no longer possible because of the saltwater change. We're getting ghost forests all up and down the coastline, these forests of trees that can no longer live in saltwater. And the world's changing in front of our eyes. It's hard to see day to day because we look out for the big events and the storms and, you know, sudden things like tsunamis and earthquakes. But sea level is that drip filling the bucket that will change the world. It will change the maps over the course of this century as places disappear.
As you kind of wrap up the book, you talk a little bit about, you know, seeing the glass as half full and recognizing that there are some opportunities ahead. So can you take just like 2 minutes to kind of give us a little hint of what you cover there?
Sure. Thanks, Nell. It's really important because this is a sober, somber, and sad subject in many, many ways, of course. We thought the shoreline is permanent. But it's important to find hope and to find a light at the end of the tunnel. And I do take pains to do that and have a couple of chapters on that. For the trillions of dollars that we will lose to the ocean this century, which we will, there will be new assets created on high ground or inland or on floats. And those that can see that will not only help the transition, but will find business opportunities. And I think that's really important because we all have to find different motivations to do this adaptation because we're now past the point of no return. And then I talk about just the psychological aspects that, both at a personal family level, but even at a professional level, that engineers and architects and attorneys and bankers may not fully understand this, but those that look into the subject will get in on the vanguard of their professions that are dealing with the new reality of unstoppable sea level rise. So those are career opportunities. And conversely, and finally, what I wave the flag at is besides seeing an opportunity, I want engineers, architects, attorneys, and bankers, the same group I just named, to realize that if they don't wake up to this, they're going to face negligence at some point, or could, I should say. And that's equally important as a motivator. So there's lots of reasons why we need to get over our angst and concern and disappointment and regrets that we didn't do something 30 years ago. The world is what it is today, and we've got to prepare for the world of tomorrow. And there's obviously some very disturbing concerns, but we have to see hope and we have to see opportunity. And I try and paint that picture in the book.
Again, the name of the book is Moving to Higher Ground, Rising Sea Level and the Path Forward. The author is oceanographer John Englander. The book is out today. Again, thank you so much, John, for taking the time to chat with Nell and me on This Green Earth. And we look forward to the next book and an update 6 or 7 years from now, right?
Right. Well, thank you, Chris and Nell. And there's more information on my website, which is johnenglander.net. And I'm on all the social media. So I look forward to connecting with you and your great audience. Thank you.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this episode of This Green Earth.
And if you did, we hope you'll take a minute to rate us, share us, and leave a comment.
You can email us your thoughts and ideas for future shows at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Join us next week on This Green Earth.